Part 4. The Elements of Human Character. Chapter 12. Political Elements. Curium, Polonium, Lutetium, Hafnium, Protactinium, Lanthanum, Mitnurium. The human mind and brain are the most complex structures known to exist. They burden humans with strong, complicated, and often contradictory desires. And even something as austere and scientifically pure as the periodic table reflects those desires. Fallible human beings constructed the periodic table, after all. Even more than that, the table is where the conceptual meets the grubby, where our aspirations to know the universe, humankind's noblest faculties, have to interact with the material matter that makes up our world, the stuff of our vices and limitations. The periodic table embodies our frustrations and failures in every human field, economics, psychology, the arts, and, as the legacy of Gandhi and the trials of iodine prove, politics. No less than a scientific, there's a social history of the elements. That history can best be traced through Europe, starting in a country that was as much of a pawn for colonial powers as Gandhi's India. Like a cheap theater set, Poland has been called a country on wheels for all its exits and entrances on the world stage. The empires surrounding Poland, Russia, Austria, Hungary, Prussia, and Germany, have long held war scrimmages on this flat, undefended turf and have taken turns carving up God's playground politically. If you randomly select a map from any year in the past 5 centuries, the odds are good that Polska, Poland, will be missing. Fittingly, Poland did not exist when one of the most illustrious Poles ever, Marie Skłodowska, was born in Warsaw in 1867, just as Mendeleev was constructing his great tables. Russia had swallowed Warsaw up 4 years earlier after a doomed, as most Polish ones were, revolt for independence. Tsarist Russia had backward views on educating women, so the girl's father tutored her himself. She showed aptitude in science as an adolescent, but also joined bristly political groups and agitated for independence. After demonstrating too often against the wrong people, Skłodowska found it prudent to move to Poland's other great cultural center, Krakow, which at the time, was Austrian. Even there, she could not obtain the science training she coveted. She finally moved to the Sorbonne in faraway Paris. She planned to return to her homeland after she earned a PhD, but upon falling in love with Pierre Curie, she stayed in France. In the 1890s, Marie and Pierre Curie began perhaps the most fruitful collaboration in science history. Radioactivity was the brilliant new field of the day, and Marie's work on uranium, the heaviest natural element, provided a crucial early insight. Its chemistry was separate from its physics. Atom for atom, pure uranium emitted just as many radioactive rays as uranium in minerals, because the electron bonds between a uranium atom and the atoms surrounding it, its chemistry, did not affect if or when its nucleus went radioactive, its physics. Scientists no longer had to examine millions of chemicals and tediously measure the radioactivity of each, as they must do to figure out melting points, for instance. They needed to study only the 90-some elements on the periodic table. This vastly simplified the field, clearing away the distracting cobwebs and revealing the wooden beam holding up the edifice. The Curies shared the 1903 Nobel Prize in Physics for making this discovery. During this time, life in Paris satisfied Marie, and she had a daughter, Irène, in 1897. But she never stopped viewing herself as Polish. Indeed, Curie was an early example of a species whose population exploded during the 20th century, the refugee scientist. Like any human activity, science has always been filled with politics, with backbiting, jealousy, and petty gambits. Any look at the politics of science wouldn't be complete without examples of those. But the 20th century provides the best, i.e. the most appalling, historical examples of how the sweep of empires can also warp science. politics marred the careers of probably the two greatest women scientists ever, and even purely scientific efforts to rework the periodic table opened rifts between chemists and physicists. More than anything, politics proved the folly of scientists burying their heads in lab work and hoping the world around them figured out its problems as tidily as they did their equations. Not long after her Nobel Prize, Curie made another fundamental discovery. After running experiments to purify uranium, she noticed, curiously, that the leftover waste she normally discarded was 300 times more radioactive than uranium. Hopeful that the waste contained an unknown element, she and her husband rented a shed once used to dissect corpses and began boiling down thousands of pounds of pitch blende, a uranium ore, in a cauldron and stirring it with an iron rod almost as big as myself, she reported, just to get enough grams of the residue to study properly. It took years of oppressively tedious work, but the labor culminated in two new elements, and was consummated with, since they were elements far, far more radioactive than anything known before, another Nobel Prize in 1911, this one in chemistry. It may seem odd that the same basic work was recognized in different prize categories, but back then the distinction between fields in atomic science wasn't as clear as it is today. Many early winners in both chemistry and physics won for work related to the periodic table, since scientists were still sorting the table out. Only by the time Glenn Seaborg and his crew created Element 96 and named it curium in Marie's honor was the work considered firmly chemistry. Nevertheless, no one but Marie Curie emerged from that early era with more than one Nobel. As discoverers of the new elements, the Curies earned the right to name them. To capitalize on the sensation these strange radioactive metals caused, not least because one of the discoverers was a woman, Marie called the first element they isolated polonium, from the Latin word for Poland, Polonia, after her non-existent homeland. No element had been named for a political cause before, and Marie assumed that her daring choice would command worldwide attention and invigorate the Polish struggle for independence. Not quite. The public blinked and yawned, then gorged itself on the salacious details of Marie's personal life instead. First, tragically, a street carriage ran over and killed Pierre in 1906, which is why he didn't share the second Nobel Prize. Only living people are eligible for the prize. Author's note, Pierre might not have lived long anyway. In a poignant memory, Rutherford once recalled watching Pierre Curie do an astounding glow-in-the-dark experiment with radium. But in the feeble green glow, the alert Rutherford noticed scars covering Pierre's swollen, inflamed fingers and saw how difficult it was for him to grasp and manipulate a test tube. A few years later, in a country still seething over the Dreyfus affair, when the French army fabricated evidence of spying against a Jewish officer named Dreyfus and convicted him of treason, the prestigious French Academy of Sciences rejected Marie for admission for being a woman, which was true, and a suspected Jew, which wasn't. Soon after, she and Paul Langevin, her scientific colleague and, as it turned out, lover, attended a conference in Brussels together. Miffed at their holiday, Mrs. Langevin sent Paul and Marie's love letters to a scurrilous newspaper, which published all the juicy bits. A humiliated Langevin ended up fighting pistol duels to salvage Curie's honor, though no one was shot. The only casualty resulted when Mrs. Langevin KO'd Paul with a chair. The Langevin scandal broke in 1911, and the Swedish Academy of Sciences debated nixing Curie's nomination for her second Nobel Prize, fearing the political fallout of attaching itself to her. It decided it couldn't, in good scientific conscience, do that. But it did ask her not to attend the ceremony in her honor. She flauntingly showed up anyway. Marie had a habit of flouting convention. Once, while visiting an eminent male scientist's home, she ushered him and a second man into a dark closet to show off a vial of a radioactive metal that glowed in the dark. Just as their eyes adjusted, a curt knock interrupted them. One of the men's wives was aware of Curie's femme fatale reputation, and thought they were taking a little long in there. Marie found a slight reprieve from her rocky personal life when the cataclysm of World War I and the breakup of European empires resurrected Poland, which enjoyed its first taste of independence in centuries. But naming her first element after Poland contributed nothing to the effort. In fact, it turned out to have been a rash decision. As a metal, polonium is useless. It decays so quickly it might have been a mocking metaphor for Poland itself. And with the demise of Latin, its name calls to mind not Polonia, but Polonius, the doddering fool from Hamlet. Worse, the second element, radium, glows a translucent green and soon appeared in consumer products worldwide. People even drank radium-infused water from radium-lined crocks called Revigators as a health tonic. A competing company, Radithor, sold individual pre-seeped bottles of radium and thorium water. Author's note, the most famous casualty of the radium craze was the steel tycoon Eben Byers, who drank a bottle of Radithor's radium water every day for 4 years, convinced it would provide him with something like immortality. He ended up wasting away and dying from cancer. Byers wasn't any more fanatical about radioactivity than a lot of people. He simply had the means to drink as much of the water as he wished. The Wall Street Journal commemorated his death with the headline, "The radium water worked fine until his jaw came off." In all, radium overshadowed its brother and caused exactly the sensation Curie had hoped for with polonium. Moreover, polonium has been linked to lung cancer from cigarettes, since tobacco plants absorb polonium excessively well and concentrate it in their leaves. Once incinerated and inhaled, the smoke ravishes lung tissue with radioactivity. Of all the countries in the world, only Russia, the many-time conqueror of Poland, bothers to manufacture polonium anymore. That's why when ex-KGB spy Alexander Litvinenko ate polonium-laced sushi and appeared in videos looking like a teenage leukemia victim, having lost all his hair, even his eyebrows, his former Kremlin employers became the prime suspects. Historically, only a single case of acute polonium poisoning has approached the drama of Litvinenko's, that of Irène Joliot-Curie, Marie's slender, sad-eyed daughter. A brilliant scientist herself, Irène and her husband, Frédéric Joliot-Curie, picked up on Marie's work and soon one-upped her. Rather than just finding radioactive elements, Irène figured out a method for converting tame elements into artificially radioactive atoms by bombarding them with subatomic particles. This work led to her own Nobel Prize in 1935. Unfortunately, Joliot-Curie relied on polonium as her atomic bombardier. And one day in 1946, not long after Poland had been wrested from Nazi Germany, only to be taken over as a puppet of the Soviet Union, a capsule of polonium exploded in her laboratory, and she inhaled Marie's beloved element. Though spared Litvinenko's public humiliation, Joliot-Curie died of leukemia in 1956, just as her mother had 22 years before. The helpless death of Irène Joliot-Curie proved doubly ironic because the cheap, artificial radioactive substances she made possible have since become crucial medical tools. When swallowed in small amounts, radioactive tracers light up organs and soft tissues as effectively as X-rays do bones. Virtually every hospital in the world uses tracers, and a whole branch of medicine, radiology, deals exclusively in that line. It's startling to learn, then, that tracers began as no more than a stunt by a graduate student, a friend of Joliot-Curie's, who sought revenge on his landlady. In 1910, just before Marie Curie collected her second Nobel Prize for radioactivity, young Georgi Hevesi arrived in England to study radioactivity himself. His university's lab director in Manchester, Ernest Rutherford, immediately assigned Hevesi the Herculean task of separating out radioactive atoms from non-radioactive atoms inside blocks of lead. Actually, it turned out not to be Herculean, but impossible. Rutherford had assumed the radioactive atoms, known as radium-D, were a unique substance. In fact, radium-D was radioactive lead and therefore could not be separated chemically. ignorant of this, have she wasted 2 years tediously trying to tease lead and radium D apart before giving up. Hevesi, a bald, droopy-cheeked, mustached aristocrat from Hungary, also faced domestic frustrations. Hevesi was far from home and used to savory Hungarian food, not the English cooking at his boarding house. After noticing patterns in the meals served there, Hevesi grew suspicious that, like a high school cafeteria recycling Monday's hamburgers into Thursday's beef chili, his landlady's fresh daily meat was anything but. When confronted, she denied this, so Hevesi decided to seek proof. Miraculously, he'd achieved a breakthrough in the lab around that time. He still couldn't separate radium D, but he realized he could flip that to his advantage. He'd begun musing over the possibility of injecting minute quantities of dissolved lead into a living creature and then tracing the element's path, since the creature would metabolize the radioactive and non-radioactive lead the same way, and the radium D would emit beacons of radioactivity as it moved. If this worked, he could actually track molecules inside veins and organs, an unprecedented degree of resolution. Before he tried this on a living being, Hevesi decided to test his idea on the tissue of a non-living being, a test with an ulterior motive. He took too much meat at dinner one night, and when the landlady's back was turned, sprinkled hot lead over it. She gathered his leftovers as normal, and the next day Hevesi brought home a newfangled radiation detector from his lab buddy, Hans Geiger. Sure enough, when he waved it over that night's goulash, Geiger's counter went furious. Click, 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 click. Hevesi confronted his landlady with the evidence. But being a scientific romantic, Hevesi no doubt laid it on thick as he explained the mysteries of radioactivity. In fact, the landlady was so charmed to be caught so cleverly with the latest tools of forensic science that she didn't even get mad. There is no historical record of whether she altered her menu, however. Soon after developing elemental tracers, Hevesi's career blossomed, and he continued to work on projects that straddled chemistry and physics. Yet those two fields were clearly diverging, and most scientists picked sides. Chemists remained interested in whole atoms bonding to one another. Physicists were fascinated with the individual parts of atoms and with a new field called quantum mechanics, a bizarre but beautiful way to talk about matter. Hevesi left England in 1920 to study in Copenhagen with Niels Bohr, a major quantum physicist. And it was in Copenhagen that Bohr and Hevesi unwittingly opened the crack between chemistry and physics into a real political rift. In 1922, the box for element 72 on the periodic table stood blank. Chemists had figured out that the elements between 57, lanthanum, and 71, lutetium, all had rare earth DNA. Element 72 was ambiguous. No one knew whether to tack it onto the end of the hard-to-separate rare earths, in which case element hunters should sift through samples of the recently discovered lutetium, or to provisionally classify it as a transition metal, deserving its own column. According to lore, Niels Bohr, alone in his office, constructed a nearly Euclidean proof that element 72 was not a lutetium-like rare earth. Remember that the role of electrons in chemistry was not well known, and Bohr supposedly based his proof on the strange mathematics of quantum mechanics, which says that elements can hide only so many electrons in their inner shells. Lutetium and its F shells had electrons stuffed into every sleeve and cranny, and Bohr reasoned that the next element had no choice but to start putting electrons on display and act like a proper transition metal. Therefore, Bohr dispatched Hevesi and physicist Dirk Coster to scrutinize samples of zirconium, the element above number 72 on the table and its probable chemical analog. In perhaps the least sweat discovery in periodic table history, Hevesi and Coster found element 72 on their first attempt. They named it hafnium, from Hafnia, the Latin name for Copenhagen. Quantum mechanics had won over many physicists by then, but it struck chemists as ugly and unintuitive, This wasn't stodginess as much as pragmatism. That funny way of counting electrons seemed to have little to do with real chemistry. However, Bohr's predictions about hafnium, made without setting foot in a lab, forced chemists to swallow hard. Coincidentally, Hevesy and Coster made their discovery just before Bohr accepted the 1922 Nobel Prize in Physics. They informed him by telegram in Stockholm, and Bohr announced their discovery in a speech. This made quantum mechanics look like the evolutionary science, since it dug deeper into atomic structure than chemistry could. A whispering campaign began, and as with Mendeleev before him, Bohr's colleagues soon imbued Bohr, already inclined to scientific mysticism, with oracular qualities. That's the legend, anyway. The truth is a little different. At least three scientists preceding Bohr, including a chemist who directly influenced Bohr, wrote papers as far back as 1895 that linked element 72 to transition metals such as zirconium. These men weren't geniuses ahead of their time, but pedestrian chemists with little knowledge of or interest in quantum physics. It seems that Bohr poached their arguments when placing hafnium, and probably used his quantum calculations to rationalize a less romantic but still viable chemical argument about its spot on the table. Author's note, for the true story of hafnium's discovery, see Eric Sherry's The Periodic Table, a thorough and superbly documented account of the rise of the periodic system, including the often strange philosophies and worldviews of the people who founded it. Yet, as with most legends, what's important isn't the truth, but the consequences, how people react to a story. And as the myth was bruited about, people clearly wanted to believe that Bohr had found hafnium through quantum mechanics alone. Physics had always worked by reducing nature's machines into smaller pieces, and for many scientists, Bohr had reduced dusty, fusty chemistry to a specialized and suddenly quaint branch of physics. Philosophers of science also leapt on the story to proclaim that Mendeleevian chemistry was dead and Bohrian physics ruled the realm. What started as a scientific argument became a political dispute about territory and boundaries. Such is science, such is life. The legend also lionized the man at the center of the brouhaha, Georgi Hevesy. Colleagues had already nominated Hevesy for a Nobel Prize by 1924 for discovering hafnium, but there was a dispute over priority with a French chemist and dilettante painter, Georges Urbain, who had once tried and failed to embarrass Henry Moseley with his sample of rare earth elements, had discovered lutetium in 1907. Much later, he claimed he had found hafnium, a rare earth flavor of hafnium, mixed in with his samples. Most scientists didn't find Urbain's work convincing, and unfortunately, Europe was still divided by the recent unpleasantries in 1924, so the priority dispute took on nationalistic overtones. The French considered Bohr and Hevesy Germans, even though they were Danish and Hungarian, respectively. One French periodical sniffed that the whole thing stinks of Huns, as if Attila himself had discovered the element. Chemists also mistrusted Hevesy for his dual citizenship in chemistry and physics, and that, along with the political bickering, prevented the Nobel Committee from giving him the prize. Instead, it left the 1924 prize blank. Saddened but unbowed, Hevesy left Copenhagen for Germany and continued his important experiments on chemical tracers. In his spare time, he even helped determine how quickly the human body recycles an average water molecule, 9 days, by volunteering to drink special heavy water in which some hydrogen atoms have an extra neutron, and then having his urine weighed each day. As with the landlady meat incident, he wasn't big on formal research protocol. All the while, chemists such as Irène Joliot-Curie repeatedly and futilely nominated him for a Nobel Prize. Annually unrewarded, Hevesy grew a little despondent. But unlike with Gilbert Lewis, the obvious injustice aroused sympathy for Hevesy, and the lack of a prize strangely bolstered his status in the international community. Author's note. Hevesi performed heavy water experiments on goldfish as well as himself, and he ended up killing a number of them. Gilbert Lewis also used heavy water in a last-ditch effort to win the Nobel Prize in the early 1930s. Lewis knew that Harold Urey's discovery of deuterium, heavy hydrogen with an extra neutron, would win the Nobel Prize, as did every other scientist in the world, including Urey. After a mostly lackluster career that included ridicule from his in-laws, he came home right after discovering deuterium and told his wife, "Honey, our troubles are over." Lewis decided to hitch himself to this no-miss prize by investigating the biological effects of water made with heavy hydrogen. Others had the same idea, but Berkeley's physics department, headed by Ernest O. Lawrence, happened to have the world's largest supply of heavy water quite by accident. The team had a tank of water it had been using for years in radioactivity experiments, and the tank had a relatively high concentration of heavy water, a few ounces. Lewis begged Lawrence to let him purify the heavy water, and Lawrence agreed on the condition that Lewis give it back after his experiments, since it might prove important in Lawrence's research, too. Lewis broke his promise. After isolating heavy water, he decided to give it to a mouse and see what happened. One queer effect of heavy water is that, like ocean water, the more you drink, the more throat-scratchingly thirsty you feel, since the body cannot metabolize it. Hevesi ingested heavy water in trace amounts, so his body really didn't notice. But Lewis's mouse gulped all the heavy water in a few hours and ended up dead. Killing a mouse was hardly a Nobel Prize-worthy exercise, and Lawrence went apoplectic when he learned a lousy rodent had peed away all his precious heavy water. Nonetheless, with his Jewish ancestry, Hevesi soon faced direr problems than the lack of a Nobel Prize. He left Nazi Germany in the 1930s for Copenhagen again and remained there through August 1940, when Nazi stormtroopers knocked on the front door of Bohr's Institute. And when the hour called for it, Hevesi proved himself courageous. Two Germans, one Jewish and another a Jewish sympathizer and defender, had sent their gold Nobel Prizes to Bohr for safekeeping in the 1930s, since the Nazis would likely plunder them in Germany. However, Hitler had made exporting gold a state crime, so the discovery of the metals in Denmark could lead to multiple executions. Hevesi suggested they bury the metals, but Bohr thought that was too obvious. So, as Hevesi later recalled, "While the invading forces marched in the streets of Copenhagen, I was busy dissolving Max von Laue's and also James Franck's metals. To do this, he used aqua regia, a caustic mix of nitric and hydrochloric acids that fascinated alchemists because it dissolved royal metals such as gold, though not easily," Hevesi remembered. When the Nazis ransacked Bohr's Institute, they scoured the building for loot or evidence of wrongdoing, but left the beaker of orange aqua regia untouched. Hevesi was forced to flee to Stockholm in 1943, but when he returned to his battered laboratory after VE Day, he found the innocuous beaker undisturbed on a shelf. He precipitated out the gold, and the Swedish Academy later recast the metals for Franck and Laue. Hevesi's only complaint about the ordeal was the day of lab work he missed while fleeing Copenhagen. Amid those adventures, Hevesi continued to collaborate with colleagues, including Joliot Curie. In fact, Hevesi was an unwitting witness to an enormous blunder by Joliot Curie, which prevented her from making one of the great scientific discoveries of the 20th century. That honor fell to another woman, an Austrian Jew who, like Hevesi, fled Nazi persecution. Unfortunately, Lise Meitner's run-in with politics, both worldly and scientific, ended rather worse than Hevesi's. Meitner and her slightly younger collaborator, Otto Hahn, began working together in Germany just before the discovery of element 91. Its discoverer, Polish chemist Kazimierz Fajans, had detected only short-lived atoms of the element in 1913, so he named it brevium. Meitner and Hahn realized in 1917 that most atoms of it actually live hundreds of thousands of years, which made brevium sound a little stupid. They rechristened it protactinium, or parent of actinium, the element into which it eventually decayed. No doubt Fiennes protested this rejection of Brevium. Although he was admired for his grace among high society types, contemporaries say the Pole had a pugnacious and tactless streak in professional matters. Indeed, there's a myth that the Nobel Committee had voted to award Fiennes the vacant 1924 Chemistry Prize, the one Hevesy supposedly missed, for work on radioactivity, but rescinded it as punishment for hubris when a photo of Fiennes and a story headlined K. Fiennes to receive Nobel Prize appeared in a Swedish newspaper before the formal announcement. Fiennes always maintained that an influential and unfriendly committee member had blocked him for personal reasons. Author's note, Casimir's Fiennes' son, Stefan Fiennes, now a professor emeritus of internal medicine at the University of Michigan's medical school, kindly supplied information to me in an email. In 1924, I was 6 years old, but either then and certainly in the years to follow, I did hear from my father of some aspects of the Nobel Prize story. That a Stockholm newspaper published a headline, K. Fiennes to receive Nobel Prize, I do not know whether it was in chemistry or physics, is not rumor, but fact. I remember seeing a copy of that newspaper. I also remember seeing in that newspaper a photo of my father walking in front of a building in Stockholm, probably taken earlier, in somewhat formal dress, but not formal for that time. What I did hear was that an influential member of the committee blocked the award to my father for personal reasons. Whether that was rumor or fact is impossible to know unless someone could look at the minutes of those meetings. I believe they are secret, but I do know as a fact that my father expected to receive the Nobel Prize as intimated to him by some people in the know. He expected to receive it in the years to follow. But it never happened, as you know. Officially, the Swedish Academy said it had left that year's prize blank and kept the prize money to shore up its endowment, which, it complained, had been decimated by high Swedish taxes. But it released that excuse only after a public outcry. At first, it just announced there would be no prizes in multiple categories and blamed a lack of qualified candidates. We may never know the real story, since the Academy says that such information is deemed secret for all times. Regardless, Brevium lost out, Protactinium stuck, and Meitner and Hahn sometimes receive credit for co-discovering element 91 today. Author's note, Meitner and Hahn actually named their element Protoactinium, and only in 1949 did scientists shorten it by removing the extra O. However, there's another, more intriguing story to unpack in the work that led to the new name. The scientific paper that announced the long-lived protactinium betrayed the first signs of Meitner's unusual devotion to Hahn. It was nothing sexual. Meitner never married, and no one has ever found evidence she had a lover. But at least professionally, she was smitten with Hahn. That's probably because Hahn had recognized her worth and chosen to work alongside her in a retrofitted carpentry shop when German officials refused to give Meitner, a woman, a real lab. Isolated in the shop, they fell into a pleasing relationship where he performed the chemistry, identifying what elements were present in radioactive samples, and she performed the physics, figuring out how Hahn had gotten what he had said. Unusually, though, Meitner performed all the work for the final published protactinium experiments because Hahn was distracted with Germany's gas warfare during World War I. She nevertheless made sure he received credit. Remember that favor. After the war, they resumed their partnership, but while the decades between wars were thrilling in Germany scientifically, they proved scary politically. Hahn, strong-jawed, mustached, of good German stock, had nothing to fear from the Nazi takeover in 1932. Yet, to his credit, when Hitler ran all the Jewish scientists out of the country in 1933, causing the first major wave of refugee scientists, Hahn resigned his professorship in protest, though he continued to attend seminars. Meitner, though raised a proper Austrian Protestant, had Jewish grandparents. Characteristically, and perhaps because she had at last earned her own real research lab, she downplayed the danger and buried herself in scintillating new discoveries in nuclear physics. The biggest of those discoveries came in 1934 when Enrico Fermi announced that by pelting uranium atoms with atomic particles, he had fabricated the first transuranic elements. This wasn't true, but people were transfixed by the idea that the periodic table was no longer limited to 92 entries. A fireworks display of new ideas about nuclear physics kept scientists busy around the world. That same year, another leader in the field, Irène Joliot-Curie, did her own bombardments. After careful chemical analysis, she announced that the new transuranic elements betrayed an uncanny similarity to lanthanum, the first rare earth. This, too, was unexpected. So unexpected that Hahn didn't believe it. Elements bigger than uranium simply could not behave exactly like a tiny metallic element nowhere near uranium on the periodic table. He politely told Frédéric Joliot-Curie that the lanthanum link was hogwash and vowed to redo Irène's experiments to show that the transuranics were nothing like lanthanum. Also in 1938, Meitner's world collapsed. Hitler boldly annexed Austria and embraced all Austrians as his Aryan brethren, except anyone remotely Jewish. After years of willed invisibility, Meitner was suddenly subject to Nazi pogroms. And when a colleague, a chemist, tried to turn her in, she had no choice but to flee with just her clothes and 10 Deutschmarks. She found refuge in Sweden and accepted a job at, ironically, one of the Nobel Science Institutes. Despite the hardships, Hahn remained faithful to Meitner, and the two continued to collaborate, writing letters like clandestine lovers and occasionally rendezvousing in Copenhagen. During one such meeting in late 1938, Hahn arrived a little shaken. After repeating Irène Joliot-Curie's experiments, he had found her elements. And they not only behaved like lanthanum and another nearby element she'd found, barium, but according to every known chemical test, they were lanthanum and barium. Hahn was considered the best chemist in the world, but that finding contradicted all previous experience, he later admitted. He confessed his humbling bafflement to Meitner. Meitner wasn't baffled. Out of all the great minds who worked on transuranic elements, only hard-eyed Meitner grasped that they weren't transuranic at all. She alone, after discussions with her nephew and new partner, physicist Otto Frisch, realized that Fermi hadn't discovered new elements, he'd discovered nuclear fission. He'd cracked uranium into smaller elements and misinterpreted his results. The eca-lanthanum Joliot-Curie had found was plain lanthanum, the fallout of the first tiny nuclear explosions. Hevesi, who saw early drafts of Joliot-Curie's papers from that time, later reminisced on how close she'd come to making that unimaginable discovery. But Joliot-Curie, Hevesi said, didn't trust herself enough to believe the correct interpretation. Meitner trusted herself, and she convinced Hahn that everyone else was wrong. Naturally, Hahn wanted to publish these astounding results, but his collaboration with and debt to Meitner made doing so politically tricky. They discussed options, and she, deferential, agreed to name just Hahn and his assistant on the key paper. Meitner and Frisch's theoretical contributions, which made sense of everything, appeared later in a separate journal. With those publications, nuclear fission was born, just in time for Germany's invasion of Poland and the start of World War II. So began an improbable sequence of events that culminated in the most egregious oversight in the history of the Nobel Prize. Even without knowledge of the Manhattan Project, the Nobel Committee had decided by 1943 to reward nuclear fission with a prize. The question was, who deserved it? Hahn, clearly. But the war had isolated Sweden and made it impossible to interview scientists about Meitner's contributions, an integral part of the committee's decision. The committee therefore relied on scientific journals, which arrived months late or not at all, and many of which, especially prestigious German ones, had barred Meitner. The emerging divisions between chemistry and physics also made it hard to reward interdisciplinary work. After suspending the prizes in 1940, the Swedish Academy began awarding a few retroactively in 1944. First up, at long last, Hevesi won the vacant 1943 prize for chemistry, though perhaps partly as a political gesture to honor all refugee scientists. In 1945, the committee took up the more vexed matter of fission. Meitner and Hahn both had strong backroom advocates on the Nobel Committee, but Hahn's backer had the chutzpah to point out that Meitner had done no work of great importance in the previous few years, when she was hiding from Hitler. Why the committee never directly interviewed Meitner, who was working at a nearby Nobel Institute, isn't clear, although it's generally bad practice to interview people about whether they deserve a prize. Meitner's backer argued for a shared prize and probably would have prevailed given time. But when he died unexpectedly, the Axis-friendly committee members mobilized, and Hahn won the 1944 prize alone. Shamefully, when Hahn got word of his win, the Allies now had him in military custody for suspicion of working on Germany's atomic bomb. He was later cleared. He didn't speak up for Meitner. As a result, the woman he'd once esteemed enough to defy his bosses and work with in a carpentry shop got nothing. A victim, as a few historians had it, of disciplinary bias, political obtuseness, ignorance, and haste. Author's note, there's a wonderful dissection of Meitner, Hahn, and the awarding of the Nobel Prize in the September 1997 issue of Physics Today, A Nobel Tale of Postwar Injustice by Elizabeth Crawford, Ruth Lewin Syme, and Mark Walker. The article is the source of the quote about Meitner losing the prize because of disciplinary bias, political obtuseness, ignorance, and haste. The committee could have rectified this in 1946 or later, of course, after the historical record made Meitner's contributions clear. Even architects of the Manhattan Project admitted how much they owed her. But the Nobel Committee, famous for what Time magazine once called its old maid peevishness, is not prone to admit mistakes. Despite being repeatedly nominated her whole life by, among others, Kazimierz Fajans, who knew the pain of losing a Nobel better than anyone, she died in 1968 without her prize. Happily, however, history has its own balance sheet. The transuranic element 105 was originally named Hahnium, after Otto Hahn, by Glenn Seaborg, Al Giorso, and others in 1970. But during the dispute over naming rights, an international committee, as if Hahnium was Poland, stripped the element of that name in 1997, dubbing it Dubnium. Because of the peculiar rules for naming elements, basically each name gets one shot, Hahnium can never be considered as the name for a new element in the future, either. Author's note, once a name has been proposed for an element, the name gets only one shot at appearing in the periodic table. If the evidence for the element falls apart, or if the International Governing Body of Chemistry, IUPAC, rules against an element's name, it is blacklisted. This might feel satisfying in the case of Otto Hahn, but it also means that no one can ever name an element Joliotium after Irène or Frédéric Joliot-Curie, since Joliotium was once an official candidate name for element 105. It's unclear whether Giorcium has another shot. Perhaps Al Giorcium would work, although IUPAC frowns on using first and last names, and in fact once rejected Niels Bohrium in favor of plain Bohrium for element 107, a decision that didn't please the West German team that discovered 107, since Bohrium sounds too much like boron and barium. The Nobel Prize is all Hahn gets. And the committee soon crowned Meitner with a far more exclusive honor than a prize given out yearly. Element 109 is now and forever will be known as Meitnerium.